Everyone faces questions and decisions that require insight and answers as we move forward personally, professionally, and corporately in all areas of this thing we call life in America today. Hello, this is Joe Schofield, and I invite you to tune in every Monday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. as we talk together and hear from key leaders of all ages and backgrounds about your questions. Interesting, informative, intuitive, but always encouraging. Tune us in on BBS Radio Network.
Join Pastor Joe and co-hosts Commander Rob Hansen, Nancy Hansen, and Dr. Paul Hall in Raising Expectations.
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for tuning in tonight for this week's version of Raising Expectations. We kind of put a tag name on it, Patriots and Proud of It, and you're going to meet some really exciting people tonight, and we're going to take very little time getting there, but we do want to remind you that this program is comprised of a family of people of all walks and backgrounds. We like to be able to do that so that we can interact and talk and share together on all kinds of issues, from faith, finances, family, fun, and freedom in this nation today, the United States of America. And we're proud to be Americans, and we're people of great faith. I would like to introduce you also to our co-host. We begin with Dr. Paul Hall, who lives in Lompoc, California, and Dr. Craig Thayer, his wife Stephanie. She's not there tonight, but Craig, it's good to see you tonight, sir. We're glad you're here. And then also, we want you to see tonight Rob and Nancy Hansen. You know, Rob, we talk out all the time. He is still waiting to teach me how to fly that Piper Cub. We're working on that. Rob, it's good to have you here tonight, and his wife Nancy. And this is kind of an anniversary this past weekend for them, and congratulations. You are two special people. We're excited about that also. So, Craig, good to see you. Hey, all of us on our team, let's say hi to our guests today, and I'm going to turn this over to Rob to introduce them. Gentlemen, welcome to Raising Expectations.
Yeah.
Rob, would you introduce our friends for us tonight?
I'll be happy to. And before I do, I have a couple of things I want to mention. First of all, I want to mention that I'd like to dedicate the show to our classmates from Naval Academy 1977, who had lost their lives, 12 of the 14 in aviation training accidents, and the other two were lost in Beirut back in 83. Lieutenant Commander Jim Boyle, Captain Mike, I got to get my glasses on now. Mike Oler, he was actually, I think, a Marine helicopter pilot who was shot and killed by a sniper while he was doing spotter duty in Beirut. Lieutenant J.G. Tony Bellotti, who we knew, I think he was in S3s, lost at sea. Lieutenant J.G. J.W. Smith was in my plebe summer company. J.W. was a great guy. First Lieutenant Stephen Scott, Marine Corps. Lieutenant Pat Conroy. Paul Capolino, Jim Watkins, Mike Brown, Jim Search, non-aviator, but he was part of the Beirut barracks bombing, and he was one of the casualties there. Steve Burley, Bill Stuver, and Steve Garcia, who was an A6 driver up in Whidbey Island, who had been in my air wing, and he actually lost his life coming in to the break, coming back into Whidbey, and I guess departed and was too low and it was too late, and he didn't deject in the right envelope, I guess. I also want to mention, I want to also dedicate this to some of the Miramar guys that we lost. One of them is, and one of the more important ones, I think, is Pat's, Frenchie's old roommate, Dave Jethro Burdeen, who I'm still Facebook friends with, his wife, and I'm glad because it's good to keep in touch. She still lives northwest of Chicago. Scooter Lamoureux, whose father was part of the F-14 fleet introduction team. He lost his life after his command tour of VF-2, Bull.
Oh, yeah, I'm very familiar.
Oh, yeah. Fred Dillingham, who was in Pensacola with me, he was an East Coast guy. Of course, Boob Powell, who was an instructor with me, lost him out at sea. Everybody knows Bug Roach. He was coming in, I think, in an A4, and something went wrong with the plane on approach to Miramar. Bug was kind of a legend and also probably the best landing signal officer that the Navy's seen in since forever. So he was kind of a legend at Miramar. Wanted to mention Lieutenant J.G. Rob Furtado. I'd gone out when I was an instructor on a hop with him. The very next flight, he went out with Jim Barney Barnett, and they were coming back into San Diego. I think they lost their combined hydraulic system, and then, of course, snakes in the cockpit, and they were already over land east of the city of San Diego, and they had to eject. And unfortunately, Rob, I somehow broke his neck, either hitting the canopy or somewhere on the way down, landing in the electrical power lines or something. Very sad. We all went over to see Barney at Balboa Hospital, and he was pretty beat up, but he later got back to flight status. I also want to mention Lieutenant Bill Davidson. He was one of my instructors at Pensacola. He lost his life on the East Coast in an F-14. I believe it was an F-14. They actually have named an animal shelter down in Pensacola after Bill. It's the Bill Davidson Animal Shelter of Pensacola. So every time I'm down there, almost every time, I like to go down there and take some of the pit bulls and Rotties and some of the bad boy dogs out for walks, and I've never had any problems with them. Those guys are who I'd like to dedicate our show to, because they all pay the ultimate price. I also want to thank a few folks from the Miramar days, and these were the Vietnam guys. We were blessed in terms of our timing, I think, to have been trained by those who had had some serious Vietnam experience, including guys like Fingers Jack Ench, who was a POW. And he's actually featured in part of the Naval Air Station Pensacola Navy Museum, Naval Aviation Museum down there. We just had visited last summer. But there were guys, some of the senior officers. We had, you know, Wizard McCabe, Al Krause, Rick Bradley, Fox Farrell, Randy Cunningham, you know, the Navy's only ace, and we're Facebook friends too. Bill Butterworth, Bullet Bob, Canepa, Fingers, I mentioned him, Jack Ench, Spooky Akeley, and Jack Snyder, Gringo. All incredible guys with a wealth of experience, and we were very blessed to have these were the best guys that you could possibly ask for to get us up to speed. And again, one more thing before I introduce my two buds, classmates, and F-14 crazy guys. George Will had written, well, he'd actually been on TV right after the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster in 1986. George Will made the following comments, and I think it's really pertinent for tonight. George Will writes, "Most of us, most of the time, live in blissful ignorance of what a small, elite, heroic group of Americans are doing for us night and day. As we speak, all over the globe, American sailors and submariners and aviators are doing something very dangerous. People say, well, it can't be too dangerous because there are no wrecks. But the reason we don't have more accidents is that these are superb professionals. The fact that they master the dangers does not mean that the dangers aren't real. Right now, somewhere around the world, and this still applies today, by the way, young men and women are landing high-performance jet aircraft on the pitching decks of aircraft carriers at night. You can't pay people to do that. They do it out of a love of country, of adventure, of the challenge, and we all benefit from it. The very fact that we don't have to think about it tells you how superbly they're doing their job, living on the edge of danger so that the rest of us need not think about it, let alone experience it." That was George Will back in 1986, and I think his words still ring true today, not just for aviators, but at least from the Navy standpoint, you know, all over the world, above the sea, on the sea, below the sea. And I think that's just good stuff to remember. My final bit before I introduce these guys, sorry, everybody. I have to make a comment because a lot of people have certain stereotypes and images. The average naval aviator, despite the sometimes swaggering exterior, is very much capable of such feelings as love, affection, intimacy, and caring. These feelings just don't involve anyone else.
I was actually thinking about using that same joke.
So now, without further ado, I want to introduce a couple of my favorite classmates, Miramar F-14 guys. Pat Frenchy LeBlanc, I've known since plebe summer. Clay Bull, I've known since, I don't know, maybe youngster year, second class year, something like that.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Yeah, somewhere. And, you know, we studied together because we were both ocean engineering majors, which was not fun, not easy. And Frenchy, you were a mechanical engineer?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Frenchy got us, he was part of the plebe summer drum and bugle corps with me. And we were both snare drummers, and so we were the beaters, as they used to call us in the drum corps. There were the beaters and the blowers in the drum corps. Sorry. That's what they called us, folks. So, Pat, why don't you start as far as, like, where you came from and why you decided you wanted to go ahead and get to the Naval Academy, and maybe a little bit about your fun experience there. I'm sure it was as fun as we all had.
When I was in high school, I wanted to be a dentist. And my dad was a World War II pilot, and was at most of the major campaigns. He was at Pearl Harbor when they bombed, and he was a pilot. And my senior year, he approached me and said, "You know what? You've got pretty good grades. If I put in an application for Annapolis, would you consider going?" And I said, "What is Annapolis?" I had no idea. I grew up in Brobridge, Louisiana. There is absolutely no military in Brobridge, Louisiana. And I knew nothing about any of the armed forces. And my dad filled out an application. I went to school and asked a counselor about Annapolis. And I went home and said, "Sure, you do the application, and if I get it, I'll go." And so to my great surprise, a few months later, I get a letter saying, "Show up with tennis shoes and don't worry about a haircut. We'll take care of that for you."
Yes,
That's how I ended up at Annapolis. But later on found out, that was in 1973. I graduated from high school. And the Vietnam War would be winding down pretty rapidly after that. In 75, it was pretty much over and people were coming home. What I later found out is if you were a Naval Academy graduate, you were guaranteed a seat in flight school. I had an older brother who tried to get into the Navy and started flight school and was yanked out and said, "We don't need you anymore because there's a big, big decrease in the need for pilots." So he got sent home, and I was lucky enough to continue, obviously, at Annapolis, graduated, and went down to Pensacola. Probably only because at the time, mostly only Naval Academy graduates for filling the slots up at Pensacola. So I felt very fortunate to be one of them.
How long was your pool down there before you started?
We graduated in June, and I didn't make it down. They stashed me in, for 2 months, they stashed me in VF 74, an F-4 squadron in Oceana, Virginia. So before even going out of flight school, I was in an F-4 squadron, and I got to jump a ride with probably one of my first flights in an F-4 was with a guy named John Patton. He was just coming off the Blue Angels. He was the lead solo for the Blue Angels. Later on became, I think he made Admiral later on. But he was a lieutenant back then, and he asked me if I wanted to go for a ride, and I went, "Sure." And so they stuck me in the back seat of an F-4, and they said, "We're going to go out. We're going to do some radar intercepts. So we'll join up after takeoff and fly a little formation." And John told me during my brief, with him, said, "Just make sure your straps are nice and tight." I go, "Sure." So I just remember we had gotten out over the water, getting ready to do some radar intercepts. And I'm thinking, "God, I hope I don't puke." And flying formation, and John was the on the wing of his lead. And I just remember he said, okay, make sure your straps are down tight, and here we go. And he flipped the airplane inverted, and we were flying inverted formation on the lead, and the wingtip was like right at the canopy. And that was my first flight in an F-4. 2 months later, I started flight school.
Helps so to be with a Blue Angel.
And there were, you know, that squadron also had an exchange guy, a guy named Jim. I can't remember his last name. I'll think of it in a second. He was lead solo for the Thunderbirds. And so we had lead Blue Angel guy at our squadron and a lead Thunderbird guy who was in an exchange program. And that guy was outstanding too. So the experience, and most of the senior guys in that squadron were all Vietnam, you know, era guys. And so the amount of experience in VF-74 in 1977, when I was with them for that 2 months, was just phenomenal.
Yeah. What, weren't the Blues still flying F-4s then? Or did
they
go
were
to
flying F-4s. They were flying F-4s in 77.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, because I think, yeah, didn't they fly for our graduation or our June week?
I think they flew over. F-4 made a lot of noise, put out a lot of smoke. It was a great airplane.
That's right. How about you, Dave?
Okay, well, I have a very similar story. I grew up in Seattle. I'm the only member of a family of six that has not worked for Boeing. I wanted to be a civil engineer after I graduated from college. So I had my sights set on MIT or Caltech or University of Washington to study engineering, and got into my senior year of high school, hadn't made any applications yet. We had a career day, and one of the presenters at the career day was a Navy recruiter, and he had a poster of a Phantom taken off an afterburner. And I saw that and said, that really looks cool. Next day, I went and saw my counselor, and I told her about it. I said, you know, I'm really interested in studying civil engineering, but this idea of flying a jet like that sounds kind of cool to me. She goes, well, have you ever thought about going to one of the service academies? And I said, the what? Kind of same as Pat. I had never heard. Well, I mean, I had heard of the. She goes, you know, the Army-Navy game. I said, I thought that was soldiers and sailors playing football. I honestly knew nothing about the academies. So she handed me the catalog, said, take these home and read them. And I came back the next day and I said, okay, you know, I'm convinced. I want to sign up. So I wrote my letters. I got a reply back from both of my senators, Scoop Jackson and Warren Magnuson. And they both said, we're sorry, we've already made our selections. You're kind of late in the process. Thankfully, my congressman, Brock Adams, wrote me back and said, here's what I need. You know, you got to get some interviews, get some recommendations, and so on and so forth. And through him, I got my appointment. And, joined you guys in June of 73 or July, I guess it was. Mm-hmm. So once I got to the academy, I was definitely interested in aviation. Didn't really know much about the Navy's stable of aircraft, but the first thing we did when we got there plebe summer was we had to learn all about the different ships and aircraft and weaponry and so on. And I learned about this newfangled airplane that they were flying in the Navy called the F-14 Tomcat. And I fell in love with it. So the whole time I was going through the Naval Academy, I really wanted to go fly F-14s. And, you know, dreams sometimes do come true.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, 73, I think, may have been when the F-14 was first introduced into the fleet, if I recall.
Does that sound 70 right? Or 71. They made a cruise in 72.
Cruises. Okay.
Yeah, they cruised in 72, VF-1 and VF-2 on the Enterprise. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, it was still pretty new when we got there, and it was just the sexiest thing ever.
Oh, I can imagine, yeah. Now, were you in a pool, or did you jump? And by the way, for those who aren't familiar, when you graduate from the Naval Academy or any service academy and go into aviation, you go into a pool because they have firm class start dates that, I guess, you have aviation indoctrination as opposed to which is like 6 weeks, and some of it's, I don't know, nav and engines and aero, classroom stuff. And then you go out and you're in somewhere near Eglin Air Force Base for a couple days of doing, you know, quote unquote survival training. And then you actually will start the actual you know, the start of flight training from there. So the pools, and especially when you have, you know, several hundred from the Naval Academy in particular that are going to be starting, they may stagger the starting dates based on how many other inputs they're getting from either ROTC units, which there are, you know, I don't know, 50 some ROTC, Navy ROTC units in universities throughout the country. And then we have something called Aviation Officer Candidate School, AOCS, where if you didn't go Service Academy, if you didn't go ROTC, you can actually go down, well, at the time it was in Pensacola. I think it's up in Newport now, Newport, Rhode Island. But guys, if you remember the movie, An Officer and a Gentleman with Richard Gere, that was more or less what Aviation Officer Candidate School was like. A Marine drill instructor yelling and screaming at you, making you do a lot of push-ups and sit-ups and making you feel like crap for, I don't know, 14 weeks or something. And then you get through all that, and they're basically getting a condensed version of kind of our plebe summer, I guess, and part of plebe year too, or fourth class new guy, girl year. So for them, they don't have to be, obviously, from Service Academy, but you had to be a college graduate in order to get into an officer program. For the non-aviators, there is an officer candidate school up in Newport, Rhode Island, where if you're going to be a ship driver, I don't know if the sub guys, yeah, maybe they start there, I guess, officer candidate school, and then the guys that go new power are kind of in a different training pipeline after they get their commissions. But then at the time, they would have probably have needed to have been interviewed by Admiral Hyman Rickover, the father of the nuclear Navy. So I'm not too sure about that, but I don't care because we're talking aviation here. Now, you guys, if you guys have any questions,
just jump
so
in.
Far, yeah, feel free to jump in.
Well, you asked. I didn't have a pool. I actually had an early July start date. So I went right straight to Pensacola. I don't remember if I started on July 2nd or 6th or 8th or something like that. But, yeah. I mean, I got down there right off the bat.
Wow.
So it was nice.
Dave, I want to jump in with you. And Patrick, boy, we're so thankful here. Rob, we really love Rob and Nancy. We're so thankful we're all together. And I had an uncle who was a squadron leader for B-17s over Europe in World War II. Oh, is that Rob?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So, you're talking about love. We have to sort of be specific about that love thing, right?
Oh, with it. Yes. Yeah. Let me retract that. We think he's cool. Anyway, we have always, I know Paul and I talk, we've talked a lot about planes back when we were in college. Paul and I have known each other 50 years. We went in the ministry, so we didn't go that direction. I had a great friend who was a pilot. He flew F-4 Phantoms in Vietnam and had a terrible name for a pilot. His name was Dennis Jump. Did not go over too well with the last name Jump. Everybody teased him all the way through the war. But we want you to know that your service to our nation, Rob's service to our nation, my family, our families, our churches, we both pastored. We continually prayed for and had wonderful men and women like yourselves and like Rob who went out and served our country. When Rob was reading that, brother, when you were reading that, that touched all of our hearts because we never take for granted what you did all the way from Louisiana. Did I say that right, Patrick? Louisiana, right? Not Louisiana. Louisiana. There we go. And all the way back here to San Diego and other places. So I just wanted to jump in. I'm just being blessed hearing about you. And I know Rob's got stories and Paul and Dr. Craig, you may know also, Craig is a surgeon, guys. He's a trauma surgeon, and Paul is a retired pastor and educator and teacher, and that's what I have done, and you know all about Rob, so I'll jump in. But guys, you got a question, kick it over to Rob or the guys. This is really interesting.
Oh, we haven't even started yet, but
yeah, I have to say that every surgeon does a rotation through the VA hospital, and in the big war, old school, everyone would say, man, you got to become a flight surgeon. And I thought, that'd be awesome. I'd love to fly like you guys did. And then a real pilot came in and says, you're too tall. You're 6'5". You're going to hit your head in the canopy. So, sorry, but you can't go. So, that was a very depressing moment in my life.
Was it Air Force or Navy?
It was an F-16 is what he was flying.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
So that would have been the Air Force, I guess. Yeah, because I remember Bob King, call sign Kong, he was 6'5", and he made the cut, barely. But
made an extra long canopy or something.
Yeah.
The Tomcat had a really big cockpit. It was very, very roomy and comfortable.
Yeah. Especially compared to the A4.
It's not very comfortable.
That, you know, people would say in the A4, you don't fly the A4, you wear it.
Yep.
But I have to add that my dad was Navy, my grandfather was Navy, family's Navy. I never got the chance to serve. I wish I could have. My ultimate mission would have been to go to Iraq or the Gulf War, although I was in training at that point. But to serve for our troops. And, and you guys are right. You know, I have this beautiful library behind me, and it's got my parents' books in there, one of which is the complete story of World War II, and it's a compilation of who was in command at the time. And Franklin D. Roosevelt wrote a very interesting article with supports. I don't think this is a world, you know, the world's listening to what we're broadcasting right now. And I don't always think that the world understands what you guys are doing. And I felt like just to honor you guys reading quickly, because I don't want to take up your time, but apparently there were the 10 commandments of Franklin D. And it was about what the war was about. And the first one he wrote, "We are fighting today for security, for progress, and for peace, not only for ourselves, but all men, not only for one generation, but for all generations. We are fighting to cleanse the world of ancient evils, ancient ills. We are fighting as our fathers have fought to uphold the doctrine that all men are equal in the sight of God." Number 5. "The essence of our struggle is that men shall be free. There can be no real freedom for the common man without enlightened social policies. In last analysis, they are the stakes for which democracies are today fighting." Number 7. "It is useless to win battles if the cause for which we fought these battles are lost. This is your guys' purpose. You kept these things alive. It is useless to win a war unless it stays won. We are therefore fight for the restoration and perpetuation of faith and hope throughout the world. The objective of today is clear and realistic. It is to destroy completely the military power of Germany, Italy, and Japan." This is again World War II. "To such poor purpose that their threat against us and all the other United Nations cannot be revived in a generation hence." And the last one I'll read, "The overwhelming majority of all people in the world want peace. Most of them are fighting for the attainment of peace, not just a truce, not just an armistice, but peace that is as strongly enforced and as durable as mortal can make it. American boys are fighting today in snow-covered mountains, in malaria jungles, etc. And the thing for which they struggle is best symbolized by that the message that came out of Bethlehem." So I just admire what he could do back then. And unfortunately,
awesome.
You know, government has to hide from religion. But there's a higher power. Can you guys defend that?
Oh, absolutely.
Jamie Jones.
Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah. I think
value that, you guys
well,
for,
I guess I would
for,
like I, to...
for being downrange and taking on that responsibility.
I think the farther and farther we get removed from World War II, the fewer and fewer people remember those sacrifices and the reasons behind them. And it doesn't bode well for our future as people continue to want to rewrite history and forget about all those things that you just read about. That's really very enlightening. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my dad, as I'd mentioned earlier, in earlier episodes here, flew B-24s in the South Pacific in World War II, and had gotten shot down. And obviously that had a bit, his experience in World War II. And even though he didn't talk about it like most people, he had that certain World War II. He had I guess we call him a cruise book, where he had a book. He was with the 5th Army Air Corps. And his cruise book was called The Menace from Moresby, which is like Port Moresby, I think, in New Guinea or something. And he had flown out of there, flown out of Clark Air Base in the Philippines, which we're all kind of familiar with since we were all West Coast guys, right? And going through the book, seeing, you know, the planes up in the sky and some of these guys taking pictures while AAA's coming and bursting nearby them and everything, and seeing some jungle scenes where, well, Japanese who were, overripened from the sun, shall we say?
Right.
That obviously had a fairly big impact on my life. And like Pat and Bill were saying about, at the time when we were going in, Vietnam was starting to wind down. And while we were in high school, most of the guys, most of my friends thought I was crazy to think about going into a service academy because, you know, the general consensus, probably media induced, was, you know, the anti-war movement was, you know, still in full swing. And I remember some of the classmates from high school that were thinking, well, do I go to Canada or do I go to Sweden? You know, and that was, again, we were sort of going against the grain of the times. But I always, you know, held true to what kind of values, I guess, and it's probably the same for Bull and Frenchie. You know, their parents brought us up and we were brought up to believe in a lot of things that these days seem to not be taught anymore. You know, duty, honor, patriotism, character, morals, and things like that, which, like Bull was saying, I mean, there's an awful lot of things that are going on right now that are very great. I'm concerned, and I'm sure all of us are too, as far as the education or lack thereof. And we were probably one of the last group of guys who probably did get a reasonable, I guess I could say public education, because I'm not a private school guy, and I suspect neither of you guys were either, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, public school. So we were in school late 60s, early 70s, Service Academy 73 through 77. Just real quick, my Naval Academy experience, this was the time where the Navy really needed nuclear-trained naval officers. We had Vice Admiral Kennard McKee, who was the superintendent at the time, and he was a nuclear submariner. We had, I remember, the entire class going into an auditorium and Navy captains coming up and talking to us about how it's very important that you guys go into the nuclear power program because, you know, we are the most, you know, technologically advanced service academy and blah, 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 blah. So here's three guys here, all engineers. we didn't drink the Kool-Aid. But I do remember my first class cruise, I was actually on a ballistic missile patrol on the USS Ethan Allen because I was still sort of wavering, you know, engineer, these guys, you know, I'm a naive kid from Wisconsin. I'm thinking, well, these Navy captains are saying that this is what we need to do. So by golly, I better look into this. And so I guess I volunteered or got picked or something to go on a boomer. We call those ballistic missile submarines boomers back in the day. Maybe they still do. But we flew all the way from Baltimore to Guam and met the Ethan Allen there, went underway, went out to sea. And it was great for about the first, you know, day or two. The only problem was there were like 58 more days to go. And I started realizing, you know, and they were making us, you know, crawl around and trace the pipings and the valves and the different systems and that make the submarine do what it does. I didn't really care for it much. So I decided after that maybe nuclear power wasn't really going to be in my future. I do have a lot of admiration and respect for the guys in our class that did go nuke. I'm sure we had some, you know, nuke sub and surface CEOs. I guess Sam was probably a surface nuke, I think. Sam, one of our classmates was a four-star SyncPAC fleet, I think. SyncPAC.
Locklear?
Yeah.
Sam Locklear?
Yeah. So he did rather well for himself.
By the way, Rob, You remember Service Selection Week at the Naval Academy? They had each night we'd go and listen to a preview of what the different selections were, surface line, Marine Corps, aviation, nuke power. I recall the aviation presentation was the most boring presentation. They didn't show any slides. They did. The only slides they showed were the chain of command of the aviation side of the Navy. They nearly put everybody to sleep because they didn't want anybody to go into naval aviation. You know, there were too many people that wanted to go naval aviation. So that presentation that night was the most boring presentation I'd ever heard. And of course, it didn't change my mind.
Yeah.
But they made nuke power and surface line and the Marine Corps seem like, oh, that's where you want to go. I mean, they had the most beautiful presentations.
Yeah.
And again, night of aviation, it was like, holy crap. They didn't show one picture of an airplane.
I have no words.
Yeah. Hey, what was your guys' scariest moment and most rewarding?
Oh, well... Cool. Yeah,
I have a good story. This was my introduction to Miramar, which is in San Diego. It used to be Miramar Naval Air Station. It's a Marine Corps base now. But I arrived in January of 79 to begin my F-14 training. As we got my class wasn't going to start till April, so we had a few things we had to do first: SEER school, water survival, a bunch of different training requirements. And also a flight syllabus of about 10 rides in the back seat of a TA-4 for instrument refresher training. Well, once I finished that, I still had a couple weeks of free time, and I've discovered that we could go out in the back seat of the TA-4s when they were working as adversaries against fighters, and it was air combat training. So I went out for a couple backseat TA-4 rides, and the second one I did was on January 30th, 79. We are out in our operating area over the ocean, and we were fighting two A-4s against two Phantoms. And on the very first engagement, we ended up pretty aggressive on one of the Phantoms, meaning, you know, he's out in front of us, and we're behind him, and we're about ready to shoot him. And his wingman was to cross from us going the opposite direction in a big tight circle. So, you know, here I am, an ensign, just got my wings, don't really know what's going on too well. But the guy I'm flying with says, you watch the guy over there, I've got the one in front of us. And so I'm watching this Phantom to my left, out at the left side of the airplane, and it just suddenly exploded. It looked to me like the middle of the airplane, back to the tail, just disintegrated in a huge fireball. The front part of the airplane immediately started just a nosedive, trailing a great big trail of smoke and flames out. And I'm thinking I'm going to see the two guys eject, you know, and I'm thinking, okay, you know, the cockpit's okay. They can eject. They'll be fine. So I watched it going down, didn't see the seats come out. But after a while, I saw two parachutes open up. Well, meanwhile, the guy I'm flying with, he's frantically calling for our wingman, the other A4. No answer. So it then became apparent that the A4 had actually collided with the Phantom. I never saw the A4 coming. I was looking at the F4 and it just blew up, but the A4 had come from the other side of it and smacked into it. Those two guys died instantly, and there was no wreckage that was even big enough to look like an airplane falling out of the sky. We stayed out there for about another hour, maybe hour and a quarter, as on-scene commander for the search and rescue operation. And there were a couple Navy helicopters that came out and picked up the pilot and the radar intercept officer out of the Phantom. We continued to look for any remains or any bodies or anything that would indicate the other two guys in the A4 were there, but we never found them. So before I ever started flying a fighter, I witnessed a mid-air collision, which was always a very real threat in the training environment that we had. So that was kind of a harsh introduction to the fighter community for me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, curious.
Yeah,
that's the reality of your world.
It was. Yep.
Yeah, and so just to get real quick, the environment that, well, the Navy in general, fighter aviation in particular, everything is, the training is exactly how we would do it in real combat situation. The only difference really is pulling the trigger or pushing the button. to release guns or missiles. Everything else that we do on a day-to-day basis, when it comes to the tactics, when it comes to electronic warfare stuff, when it comes to yanking and banking and pulling G's and, you know, getting spina problems like I still have, was all real, was all based on the way you fight like you train, basically. I think Randy Cunningham used to say that all the time. And it's true. So the training is really no different than what we would do in combat. And again, the only difference between us and combat is, yeah, we're either not pulling the trigger or pushing buttons, and nobody's throwing SAMs up in the air at us. So, and that's really the only thing that's different. That just makes it more of a, your head's on a swivel anyway, and now you got to look for other things. And we had electronic equipment that would tell us whether, and we had training at certain ranges, whether we had, you know, some surface-to-air missile radar locked onto us, or we call them the deedle deedles because they made all the electronic sounds coming out of the boxes. When we heard the deedle deedles, we knew that there was a radar that probably was either a AAA or a surface-to-air missile radar site. So just wanted to point that out. Reality for us was the same as reality would be in combat.
Pat, tell us your experience. Wow.
I spent, after flight school, I got sent to San Diego, and I went through F-4 training with VF-121 in San Diego, and then I was sent to the USS Midway, which was stationed in Atsugi, Japan, or the air wing was in Atsugi, and the ship was in Yokosuka. I had an experience on the Midway. I had just gotten on board, and I had just gotten certified to fly at night, and I was the junior guy in the squadron, the junior pilot. And of course, when you're the junior pilot, there's a lot of heat on you to hurry up and get called so you can stand the alert all night long, and the senior guys don't have to, right? So the senior guys were all excited because I finally was night qualled and I could now stand alerts. So here I am. We're on the way to the Indian Ocean, and we're on the way to the Indian Ocean to marshal off the coast of Iran because the Iranians had just taken the Americans hostage at the embassy. So Midway's on the way out. I'm on board, and it's my first alert night, which means, for those who don't know, the carrier... it's very important that the carrier self-protects itself. So there are always fighters on the carrier that are ready for launch within just a few minutes. There are pilots sitting in airplanes ready to launch in case, as a defense, in case the carrier is ever threatened. So we were very close to Singapore, and I got sent to the flight deck with my backseater. Our mission was to jump in an F-4, start the engines, check out all the weapon systems, the radar, and make sure the airplane was fully ready to go. And so I was sitting in this F-4. And of course, if you're familiar with carriers, you know that the tail end of all the airplanes generally stick out the back end off the side of the carrier. They back them up all the way to the edge of the carrier. And typically the back end of the airplanes are off the edge, over the edge. We were approached maybe 100 miles from Singapore, and a Panamanian freighter collided with the USS Midway. And it happened to collide exactly where my airplane was sitting, and my airplane, the tail of the airplane, got tangled in some of the mast and the rigging, and completely ripped off the tail of the airplane. And my airplane pretty much stood straight up, and I thought it was going to flip over backwards and maybe land in the water or land on top of the ship. And I was scared out of my mind. I'm thinking, oh, I wasn't trained for this. You normally don't train to be in an airplane and get hit by a ship. But it eventually, after the tail broke completely off the airplane, the nose fell back down to the carrier deck, And we shut down the engines, and I was injured. I had a finger that was, the canopies, both canopies broke off their hinges and from the impact. And I was holding on to the canopy bow, and I had an injured hand. So I was taken down to sick bay, and it was a major general quarters for the Midway, because we had 17 airplanes where the tail sections were damaged all the way down the side of the carrier. That ship ended up damaging 17 airplanes. So we had to do a 180 and go back to the Philippines. And that was Iran's attempt at stopping a carrier from, you know, positioning off its coast. And it worked. But we ended up losing, two people were killed in that collision. The ship impacted the side of the Midway, and just inside the hull of that ship were two guys just standing there, innocent bystanders, not knowing what was happening. And they were, killed when the hull impacted and squeezed them between two bulkheads. Mm-hmm. And there was another guy injured that was, the plane captain, for my airplane was underneath the airplane when all that went on. He ended up with a broken arm and a few other injuries. And I was the second injury got hauled down. So my parents the next day were called by the Navy, and they said, your son was injured in a major, you know, accident on the USS Midway, and he's okay. And of course, the next following day, it was front line that two people were killed and two Navy personnel injured during a collision at sea on the USS Midway. So that was my excitement during my my career. One of many.
I think that's why the Kitty Hawk was extended for a couple of months out on station there, wasn't it? You guys were going out to relieve the Kitty Hawk, so they ended up missing Christmas. They got turned around right around Thanksgiving, headed back out to the Indian Ocean, spent a few more months, and then the Independence came out from the East Coast, relieved them, and then I came out on the Ranger, and we relieved the Indy. So I was out there just, you know, a while after you were.
Yeah, we there were a lot of our classmates spent some time off the coast of Iran being entertained.
We were on station. We were on station there on the Ranger when the hostages were released, which was a major big event. It was pretty amazing.
Oh, I bet.
And that cruise ended up being an 8-month cruise also.
Wow.
Yeah, at the time I was a black shoe. I was a surface warfare guy on the USS Barbie, FF-1088. Barbie is not the Barbie doll. This was a vice admiral in World War II who actually was one of the planners of all the amphibious landings that took place in the South Pacific, you know, the Solomons and Tarawa and Iwo Jima and all that. He basically was the head planner for those amphibious landings on the island hopping campaign. Anyway, but I was on that cruise on the Barbie in 1980 when the hostage rescue attempt took place. I remember being over, and I was an officer of the deck and qualified ship driver and all that stuff. We had an Iranian F-14, or one painted like an Iranian F-14, that I never knew the answer, whether it was really one of ours or one of theirs, that actually did looked like a double SC mission, where surface surveillance planes that would come out and you'd look for different ships that are walking around the oceans or the Northern Arabian Sea in particular. And we didn't necessarily feel threatened, but we did have the gun mount, you know, pointed in certain directions, and we didn't really know what to expect. And all we did was, we were standing by to stand by. There wasn't a whole lot that we would have been able to do other than, you know, if some Iranian submarines would come out, I guess we could, you know, throw some torpedoes or ASROCs at them. But I just remember being in a state of not really knowing anything other than something is going down, and we didn't really know what it was. And it was later that hostage rescue attempt at Desert One that turned out to not be a very good operation.
Rob, we got about 5 minutes. Andrea, want to share something? Paul might, and we'll watch our time. We're really enjoying this.
Yeah, I wanted to acknowledge and honor my three brothers that were in the services. My brother, Dennis, that was in the Air Force as a jet mechanic in Okinawa. And the stories he tells about the pilots and the planes and getting them thumbs up or thumbs down were amazing. My brother, Kim, that was a gunner for the helicopter, went to Vietnam. I can't remember if it was three or four times. He has injuries and is in a wheelchair. Thank you, Kim, for your service. My brother, John, that has back injuries and pain every day of his life. But he served in communications, and I don't know all that he did. He was in Japan, but really because he was very injured. So, and I want to thank you, gentlemen, for the service to our country, for our democracy and for our freedom and for keeping America strong.
Amen.
And may you be the examples of what we need now in this country. Yes. So thank you. And I honor all of you. Thank you.
That's right. We do. Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Paul, you had a thought you might have? Amen.
Can you hear me okay?
Sure, Paul. Okay.
Dave, yes. Patrick, Rob, thanks for your service. It was 1986. I was working through my doc program in seminary. I called home. My son said, Dad, there's a movie you got to see. You got to go see this. And I said, what? He said, Top Gun, you got to see it. And so I finished my assignment, went to the theater, sat there by myself. And from the first boom, boom, boom that came up, I said, this is going to be hot. You know, this is going to be good. I want to thank you for service. I'm sure there's no way we can get our heads around to what you dealt with every day in and out, the routine and all those kind of things. I'd just like to ask a real quick question on a lighter note. Y'all have call signs, right? How did you get them and who chose them for you? Okay. Dave, can you start?
My last name is Bullard, B-U-L-L-A-R-D. My call sign was Bull. So that was just a natural. It was. I chose it myself, actually.
Okay, good. Patrick, how about you?
My last name is LeBlanc. And my dad had a call sign, Frenchie, when he was a pilot during World War II. And I think a lot of people got to learn about my dad. And by the time I was going through flight school, people started calling me Frenchie.
That's great.
And Rob, what about you? How did you get your call sign?
Well, it's an interesting story. I mean, I was one of four guys who got flown out to the USS Constellation that was already in the Philippines after two of VF-154s. F-14s did a little bit of a midair. Well, they touched each other, but one of them lost a Phoenix missile. And unknown at the time, these guys were just taking pictures of each other. Guys were just snapping, how cool the airplane looks and everything. Well, they got a little too close, of course, and bumped. And then they got on a certain radio frequency to make up a story about what really happened. But they didn't know at the time. I'm getting to that. They didn't, at the time, the carrier was recording their story. So they all ended up getting fired, basically. And so I got rushed through about my last five tactics hops and then ended up going out with three other guys. The first night that we were there in the Philippines, they called us four new guys up to the front of the ready room. And after they threw everything at us and yelled at us and told us how beautiful we were and how compassionate. No, they were basically guys being guys. They would come up and start saying, okay, the XO and the CO are right there pointing out, well, what about this guy? And, you'll notice my hair is sort of like going backward a little bit. So Bluto, Drew Bergal, you guys probably knew him, said, hey, windblown dog. No, that wasn't going to work so well. And then Mikey Adan, I think, said something like, Johansson. So that apparently stuck, yo, for Johansson. Don't ask me why. It just happens. And despite what most people realize, you normally don't have a choice of the call sign. It is given to you, or it is earned, or it's based on, like Bull, a last name. Now, you can use your imagination if you last name.
I hate to break in, everyone, but it's time to wrap.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
that's how.
Well, listen.
I love you guys. Thank you.
Rob, we've been blessed. Thanks for sharing your friends with us. And Dave and Patrick, thanks for serving your country just like Rob. And on behalf of everybody here, you know, we just want to thank you as we've shared for who you are, what you've done for us, and we never take for granted your service. So you're still going to be in our prayers. We pray God blesses you and uses you to inspire many, many, many people. And keep your eye on Rob because he's the guy who blesses us. He's a good friend, and we appreciate him. But you still can keep your eye on him because he's a character.
Yeah, we'll
we love it.
And we miss Steph.
Yes, we miss Stephanie tonight.
Tell her hello. And,
we'll have to do this again because you guys are real patient.
I think it'll be good because we just really got started. And
friends, thanks for joining us on this week's program of Raising Expectations. We profoundly hope you found it engaging and at times humorous, but most of all, uplifting, so that we may, with you, one topic at a time each week, become more encouraged to move forward to an exciting future in, as we always say, this thing called life in America today. So let not your hearts be troubled, your family, finances, faith, freedom. It can be a great future as we talk, listen, respect, and pull together. Please let me hear from you. You can reach me at 972-922-8556. That's 972-922-8556 or Joe Schofield on Facebook or LinkedIn. It'd be a pleasure to know you, and we hope you'll listen in again next week on the BBS Radio Network.